Once upon a time, there was a new crossover that refused to play by the rules. It flipped the script and made all the others look like fools. Featuring styling that's sexier by far and handles like a rock star. Introducing the first ever Toyota CHR.
Enjoy agile handling in the body of a seductive crossover that comes with standard 18-inch alloy wheels. The first ever Toyota CHR. The perfect ride to spin your own tale. Toyota. Let's go places.
Episode of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I am your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I am on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we are joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so grateful that you're here. Today's episode is about suicide bereavement or suicide grief, specifically within military families. And I have a most amazing expert in the show here for you today that I think you're going to be really inspired by. This is one of the worst things that can happen to people is losing a loved one to suicide. And after I lost my brother in 2004, he died 2 weeks before, before Christmas, 2 weeks before his 35th birthday. He was born on Christmas Eve, but also 2 weeks before the Asian tsunami hit that year. And I'm sure those of you who were old enough to remember recall what a devastating international disaster that was. And I remember thinking back months later and reflecting on our family's experience in the aftermath of Carson's death and how much that trauma really paralleled metaphorically the international response to the Asian tsunami. I mean, the first weeks were just this experience of drowning and just fighting for every breath. Everything's turned up on its head. You can't sleep. You can't eat. And I had really intense experiences of panic and fear for myself, for my kids. And they would just come and hit me and knock me off my feet. And it was really disorienting. Really strange thoughts were happening. And I felt like now, you know, I'm going to fall apart. All of these things were very disconcerting. And then I remember I had this date on the calendar that forced me to kind of come up from this drowning experience and take a good look at the landscape around me. And just like the tsunami, like everything was moved, everything was different. I didn't recognize where I was. And that was the day I had to go back to work. And I got there and I just didn't care. I didn't care about the things that I was to be doing. And previously, I was very passionate. I was teaching leadership at a university, and I loved my work. But I just felt like all my priorities were different, and I didn't know what my direction was anymore. Ripple effects through space and time, aftershocks of being hit over with memories and loss experiences really intensely for the first maybe year and a half. All of these parallels were pretty powerful. One of the things that I came to realize is that there's a real paradox in grieving suicide. On the one hand, there's this normal grieving process of really moving towards the person and really trying to embrace them, hold their memories close to your heart, and kind of this moving towards experience. And on the other side, there's also this trauma experience, which tends to be more of a moving away experience. We become frightened of the thing that traumatized us, and so we want to. The natural inclination is to try to avoid it and push it away. And so that paradox of grieving suicide is really this push-pull experience that's very confusing often for loved ones. And then over time, as I got involved with understanding the grief community around suicide and also this thing that we call postvention, which is how communities manage the impact of suicide over time. So part of that is supporting people who've been affected in their grief and trauma response. But the other part is really about minimizing the impact of what we call contagion or copycat effects. There are certain things that we know that if we do things like romanticize or glamorize suicide and the aftermath of suicide, or talk too much about the details of it, the means and the location and so forth, we actually run the risk of increasing people who are vulnerable to suicide to take action on that vulnerability. And so we need to do some really careful things around communication. And so there's a whole bunch of, I call them tensions in postvention, that really require an expert to, like our guest today, to come in and help navigate that space. And the very first one that's very evident to me as a lost survivor is navigating the space between honoring the life that was lived, honoring the gifts that that person brought to the world, sharing their story about their life and not moving away from the tragedy of their death, but really embracing that person and giving space for the grief rituals that we need as a community. So on one hand, we have this honoring loss piece, and on the other hand, we have this minimizing contagion piece. So we're trying to open people up and share stories, and at the same time, shut people down and make sure they don't tell them in the wrong way. I remember stories after a teen dies in a high school saying, "We will not have a candle lighting ceremony for this kid." And the kids were like, "Why? He was my best friend." And so it's really, really hard to navigate that space, but I think it's possible. The second tension that I see is really about acknowledging that something really important has happened. So whether that's in a school or a workplace, a faith community, wherever, how do we acknowledge that something really significant has happened to our community and at the same time have some sense of a familiar pattern reinstated? We know that when trauma happens, the quicker we can start getting back into the familiar, back into patterns that are comforting, the more soothing it is for many people. So how do we balance those two things? And then the last really significant tension that comes up in all families affected by suicide is, what do we do with the children? How do we tell children? How do we not lie to them? How do we not avoid these conversations? How are we able to share this with children in a way that's developmentally appropriate, answers their questions, and really reassures them? So that's what we're going to talk about today. And I'm also very hopeful that our expert will be able to give us some direction on what works with suicide grief support. She's done some amazing things. So whether it's professional grief counseling or peer support groups in person or online or other types of tools or books or resources, I'm hoping that we can make this a very, very rich resource conversation today. So without further ado, let me introduce our speaker today, Kim Ruocco. And she and I have known each other for a number of years. I don't remember the exact year that we met, but I do have the image in my mind of watching her facilitate a military suicide loss survivors panel and being brought to tears, hearing those heart-wrenching stories of loss and how that impacted the family, but also being incredibly inspired about all of these incredibly fierce survivors in their road to healing. Her story is this. In 2005, Kim lost her husband to suicide, Marine Corps Major John Ruocco, and subsequently she's dedicated her life to raising awareness for suicide prevention and grief support, along with the voices of thousands of military suicide survivors. She's presently a master's level clinical social worker and the chief external relations officer for the suicide prevention and postvention for the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, which is otherwise known as TAPS. And if you haven't heard of this program, TAPS, and you are connected to a military family that has been affected by any type of loss, I really encourage you to look them up. They are, bar none, the top resource for military grief, and they provide tremendous amounts of programming and support. She currently keynotes regularly at national events, and you're going to be really impressed by this list. Most notably, she's keynoted at the DOD and VA Suicide Prevention Conference and multiple stand-downs at Marine, Army, and National Guard and Navy experiences. She's appeared on CNN, Fox News, Al Jazeera, NPR, and NBC Radio, and she's been quoted in a number of magazines, Men's Health, Christian Science Monitor, Stars and Stripes, Marine Times. Like, she is the go-to expert around this particular topic. She's also assisted in the development of a number of programs, far too many for me to list here, but just to give you kind of the breadth of her experience, she helped with the development of the U.S. Marine Corps' Never Leave a Marine Behind program, which is a really innovative kind of military values-based peer support kind of program that really set the bar for all kinds of peer support pieces. She and her sons were also lead participants in the Sesame Street When Families Grieve video, which I have used in our packages that we used to send out to families here in Colorado. It's been distributed internationally to families who've experienced any kind of recent death. So huge resource to help kids process their grief and loss. But the effort that she's probably best known for is the development of comprehensive peer-based programs that offer comfort and care to all those who are grieving the loss of a service member to suicide. She created a team of peer professionals who care and provide support for nearly 8,000 survivors of military suicide. The impact of that is just unbelievable to me, the ripple effects of helping these families through that difficult time. That's huge. And the most important, the most impactful of these services is what's called the TAPS Annual Survivors of Suicide Loss Conference, which offers hope and healing to thousands of survivors and provides a camp and military mentoring for the children of the fallen. Most recently, she was recognized for her leadership with the Survivor of the Year Award from the American Association of Suicidology. So please welcome Kim to the program. Kim, say hi.
Hi, thank you so much. That was amazing, Sally. And as I listen to you, I think that we have so many parallels in our experience with suicide loss and some of our work. So I'm excited to talk more about that today and how our journeys kind of cross and match in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. So I know it's painful, but would you please kind of walk our listeners through your experience with suicide loss, kind of what led to that moment and mm-hmm. kind of how you found your way through?
Yeah, sure. So I live in Massachusetts, grew up in Massachusetts, and went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and it was there that I met my husband. We were put in a dorm together, in a co-ed dorm. The University of Massachusetts in the 80s was very liberal and very open, and they had co-ed bathrooms and co-ed dorms, and I met my husband in the bathroom of a co-ed dorm at University of Massachusetts, and fell in love immediately. You know, he was gregarious and funny and handsome, and you know, I just it was like love at first sight. So we started dating our sophomore year at University of Massachusetts, dated all through college, and you know, one of his dreams that he told me about during those days was to join the Marine Corps. He had always idolized his uncles who had fought in World War II, including his dad, who was a gunner on B-52 aircraft. He had an uncle that was in the Marine Corps, and he said that he wanted to give back to his country. He felt a real duty to do something important, to give back to his country, and to you know, be somebody who his parents could be proud of, because he was the youngest of four boys, all who were pretty successful. So he really had a drive to join the Marine Corps. One of his challenges was his mom was Irish Catholic and did not want him to join the Marine Corps, was scared to death that he would be injured. She was also didn't want to be separated from him, because all of her sons had kind of stayed around her neighborhood within a mile or so that she could stop in and have that precious Sunday afternoon dinner. So you know, that kept him from joining for a while. But as we started talking about getting married and spending a life together, it was really clear to me that, you know, if he didn't join the Marines, that he would always feel like that he didn't follow his dreams, and that he didn't do what he needed to do. And I think he would have always had regret. So we started talking about, you know, what that would look like and how we could do that together. And we decided that that dream was so important for him that we would do it, and we would do it together. So we kind of came up with this plan where I went to get my master's in social work while he went and joined the Marines mm-hmm. and went to basic school and you know, basic training and officer candidate school. And he graduated there at the top of the class and was given a flight contract, which is, you know, highly valuable and sought after in the Marine community, because there's not a lot of pilots, and those who are pilots, it's really prestigious, you know, kind of MOS to get. So he got a flight slot, and so we got married in between the basic school and flight school. I had just finished my master's. We packed up everything in Massachusetts and went to Pensacola for flight school. And we were newlyweds, and it was an amazing time. He was, you know, it was just like the movies, like you see, you know, officer and a gentleman, lots of hard work, but lots of hard play, you know, and we were just so in love and so happy to start this adventure together. He was really good at being a Marine, but especially good at being a pilot. And he graduated at the top of his class and was given COBRAs as attack helicopters, which he loved. He loved the mission of being an attack helicopter pilot, because the mission is to fly low and really protect those Marines that are on the ground, to make sure that there's no threats to them whenever they're entering combat or they're you know, trying to do a mission. That the COBRA is there to protect those Marines. And he loved that mission and took it really seriously and really became a leader among his men. People looked to him for steadiness whenever there was difficulty, for humor that broke up, you know, stressful situations, and for, you know, just somebody who was always there 100% for you. So our first duty station was in North Carolina in the 90s, and we were there for 4 years, and in those 4 years, we had both of our children were born. We had three hurricanes, two of which we were evacuated from, and John had two deployments, one to Somalia and one to Bosnia. And also during that time, we had our first multiple traumatic losses, which we don't think about with in the military. We think about combat losses and combat trauma and exposure. Mm. But for us, there was multiple accidents in the aviation community where my husband lost many of his friends in training accidents, one of which where he was flying in formation with three COBRAs.
Oh, wow.
There was a midair. So he lost multiple friends and really had his first major depression that I ever saw after one of those collisions. He started to have anxiety when he was flying. He started to have depression and having a lot of fear that he could make a mistake that would take somebody's life or that would put somebody else in harm's way. But being in the military, there's a lot of cultural messages. One of the strongest ones is that you don't tell anybody outside of your own family when your husband is having mental health issues. And back in the 90s, especially, because there wasn't clear information about what to do with mental health challenges, where to go to get help, and what would happen when you did. So even though I was a clinical social worker and I knew he was depressed, I also was very worried about saying or doing something that would make things worse for him or possibly end his career after he had worked so hard and was so good at it. Another thing that I learned during this period of his depression was that he came into the Marine Corps with an unresolved trauma that he had never talked about before. He had had a car accident in high school where he had a head-on collision where he wasn't paying attention. And somebody died, the other person in the car died. And so these multiple losses in the aviation community were now bringing up all that unresolved trauma and loss that he had from this high school accident. So, you know, we got through that period not telling anybody that he was suffering, except for one person. He trusted one leader within his squadron. We started to be afraid that he would make a mistake flying because of his depression. So we, you know, I brought him to this one person he trusted, and they basically said to us, you know, push through it. Don't take medication. Don't go to treatment. You know, push through this and get to the other side so you can maintain your career, which was the messaging in those days, you know. And
sure.
And John did. John did. He pushed through that one day at a time, sometimes crawling, sometimes walking. And he finally got to the other side of the depression. But the messages that we got around that event were dangerous. There was the message, don't tell anybody. Don't get help whenever you're suffering.
Yep.
my husband also said to me after he pulled out of that depression, I can't believe I did that to you. I'm so weak. That's disgusting. Oh. I let myself get that depressed. So he saw depression and anxiety and traumatic loss as being a failure in him, a weakness in him, not something to be treated that you can, you know, get through and get to the other side of. So we got through that time but heading into this stressful lifestyle of the military with some pretty dangerous messages about how to take care of yourself psychologically and mentally and what to do whenever you are having a crisis. Fast forward, he had a really good career in the military for the next 10 years or so. He was top in his field. He worked at the Pentagon. And then the last duty station was in Oklahoma. He was flying jets for the Air Force, training young jet pilots to fly these trainer jets before they would go to the bigger jets. We had the plan of getting out of the Marine Corps and moving back home to Massachusetts, where both of our families were, all our brothers and sisters and parents and cousins and uncles. So we had the plan of getting out and going back. So we had that plan, and we started working when 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And I'll remember that day, just like so many military families do, that day changed our course of our lives. And so many military families, whether they've lost a loved one to suicide or accident or illness or killed in action, will say that day shifted their family in a way that they look back and really pinpoint it to that moment. And that was true for our family as well. I remember John looking at me and saying, this is going to change everything for us.
Yep.
And what he meant on the look back was he didn't know how he could please everybody. You know, he was trained on COBRAs, which were going to be needed in a war. He was, you know, training these young jet pilots that they needed. He had promised his family that we would move home. And so he set on a course to try to please everybody, which is very often what Marines will do. He was flying, training to fly Southwest Airlines at the same time, retraining on the Cobra at the same time, finishing up on the T-37. So flying three aircrafts at the same time.
Wow.
And getting ready for a deployment where he was attached to a reserve unit. So John deployed to Iraq in 2004. After moving us back to Massachusetts, the family. He was attached to a reserve unit out of Pennsylvania. That deployment was a difficult one. It's when they went into Fallujah. It was one of the biggest battles. John flew 75 combat missions in his Cobra. He was highly regarded as, you know, having some heroic battles and really taking care of his men and leading. And he did really well. But when he came home from that deployment in the end of November of 2004, he was different. I immediately knew when I saw him getting off the plane that you know, he kind of had this blank stare, and he seemed distant, and he seemed agitated. My kids were 8 and 10 years old, two boys at the time, and he was kind of impatient with them and kind of, I would say, distant. We started to talk about what he was feeling, and he was overcome with darkness and anxiety from his deployment. He said that, you know, he had seen things there that it was going to be difficult to bring home, that he had done things that were difficult to reconcile. He felt he was having trouble, you know, flying the very aircraft he had just flown 75 combat missions in. And we talked a lot about him getting help. And for him, he kept, you know, saying to me, if I go and tell people I'm not okay, they're going to think I'm weak. They're going to think I don't want to redeploy. How are we going to lead people if I'm suffering from depression? And the most important thing, you know, was he felt that why was he suffering when so many other Marines were doing a similar mission and didn't seem to be suffering? So the challenge there was, like, a lot of these Marines who came back were suffering similar issues, but they weren't talking to each other about them. And John had a very, you know, specific idea in his head about who you are as a Marine and how you carry yourself and who as you, what your identity is like. And it's very much tied to pushing through pain, physically and emotionally, and not showing any weakness of any sort. And he saw his depression and his anxiety and his post-traumatic stress as a weakness in him and not an injury or an illness related to the traumas that he was exposed to. So several things happened, too, while he was deploying that made life very difficult for him. He didn't get the job with Southwest Airlines that he thought he had before he deployed. The reserve squadron that he was attached to in Pennsylvania, which was close to the home we bought, had moved to California. So he was now attached to a unit in California when his family bought a home in Massachusetts. And, you know, he had this depression again. So he struggled with that throughout the winter with us not seeing him that much because his squadron was supposed to redeploy in March, and he had just gotten back in November. So we only saw him again Thanksgiving and then Christmas. And at Christmas, I really noticed a change in him physically. I hadn't seen him in a month. And when he came home, he was thin and gaunt and withdrawn and pale. And when I look back on the pictures of him, I wonder why it wasn't more shocking to me or more red flags. But military families are so accustomed to adjusting to the service member and being understanding that it's going to be difficult for them to transition home and that they're going to have periods where it's really hard, that spouses and families are used to just supporting them and being like cheerleaders, like you can get through this and it's going to be okay and we'll take care of you and we can do this and rah, 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 instead of saying, you know, maybe you need help, you know, maybe you are sick. So on the look back, that's all clear to me, but in the middle of it, I was in cheerleader mode and trying to get him to be okay and remembering the last depression he was able to push himself through. So, you know, that Christmas we did a lot of talking about what he needed, and he still was really resistant to going to treatment and really adamant that he didn't want me to tell anybody about his suffering. And I was really hopeful that he would be able to push through it because for so many of us who have lost a loved one to suicide, there's those red flags that you see. But mixed with those red flags, there's tons of messages that let you believe or make you believe that they're going to be okay. So for right. Every time that I would say to John, you know, I'm really concerned and, you know, that's concerning what you're saying, he would say, well, I'm going to be fine tomorrow. Tomorrow will be better. Or I went for a run this morning. I feel better. Or, you know, I can push. I've done this before. I can push through again. So I was really holding on to those positive, affirming things and not paying attention to the red flags as much as I should have been in the middle of it.
You don't want to think that this is going to happen to, you know,
right.
The person you
right.
love. So you're scanning the environment for those,
mm-hmm.
okay, they're going to be fine.
Yes.
Okay, they gave me reassurance. We're good, we're good, we're good. But
right.
you're also, your brain's also trying to reconcile the things that don't fit with that narrative. And so, you know, you're always caught in the space like, is that really what's going on here? Really, I think, you know, I don't want this to be true for my
loved
one.
There's also, I think, relationship challenges
yeah.
that get in the way. Like, and I'll give you a really good example of that. During that Christmas break, he was having a really bad day, and he said to me, can we talk about how I can't feel anything? And
as
a clinician, if I was a clinician, I would have said to him, you know, tell me more about that. You know, how long you've been feeling that way? What does that mean? You know, but as a spouse, I heard, if you can't feel anything, you can't love me, right? And so we got in this
mm-hmm.
whole discussion, stupid discussion, about whether he felt love for me. And he basically got frustrated and said, I'll handle it myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I look back on that discussion and think, wow, like why could I not put my clinical hat on there? And the reason is because, you know, emotions get in the way, whether you're a parent, a spouse, a sibling, that, you know, you love this person, you want them to be okay, you hold on to all the things that they're giving you that you think is proof that they're going to be okay. And
so
emotions get in the way of you seeing clearly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to comment on that because as you're telling your story, I'm saying we have so much in common here. Not only are you know, we were both married to Marines, but we also both were mental health service providers prior to our loved one's death. And so I had the same thing with Carson. I remember, so we were estranged during the last, you know, couple of months of his life because his bipolar condition just was made him incredibly destructive and difficult to engage with. And he was very agitated and angry all the time. And so in the last couple of weeks of his life, however, he came back. And he came back full of remorse and regret, but full of love. And you know, he would hug and cry. And I'm like, oh, my God, I finally got you back. And I did not want to do anything to upset that apple cart. I was like, I don't want to challenge you. I don't want to, you know, rush you to treatment. I just want to sit here and hold you. You know, so same thing, like, with, you know, 10 years later with my clinical hat on, I'm like, oh, gosh, I could have done this differently. I could have done that differently. Why didn't I see that thing? But it was because I didn't, I so very much wanted to keep that relationship connected. So,
absolutely.
So this whole other layer of your story too, it's not the focus of today's conversation, but I just wanted to assure the listeners in case there's folks out there that, people in mental health services profession who then subsequently lose loved ones to suicide, this is a whole nother category of complication. And there is a resource called Clinician Survivors Task Force within American Association of Suicidology that I'll put in the show notes for people who have that kind of particular additional stressor. So please continue. Thank you.
Yes. So, you know, John went back to California after that Christmas break, and we talked every day. And some days he would say he was good. He went for a run. He's fine. He went to work. And other days he would have kind of dark days. So I would kind of hold on to those good days, but we still started talking about him getting help and he still was really resistant. So February 7th was Super Bowl Sunday and it was the Patriots were in the Super Bowl and that's John's team that he grew up with that he loved. And so the plan was for him to go to friends in California who were Patriots fans and watch the game. And my boys and I were watching the game with our family. And so we watched the game. They won. The Patriots won. And my boys were, you know, so excited to talk to their dad. They just wanted to talk to their dad about this game and you know, the fact that their team had won the Super Bowl. And so my oldest, who was about 10 years old, Joey, started calling his dad and calling and calling and couldn't reach him. And finally, he did reach him. And I remember hearing Joe say, Dad, did you watch the game? And then his, you know, his little face kind of changed and he looked concerned and he came over to me and he said, Mom, Dad didn't watch the game and he's crying. So, you know, as a true, you know, military spouse, I said to my son, you know, don't worry about it, honey. I'll take care of it. It's going to be fine. Dad's just probably having a bad day. You know, I took the phone and I started to talk to John. And John had not watched the game that day. He said that he couldn't get out of bed, that he didn't want people to see him like this. And for me, this was like a crashing of, I have to do something. This is the final straw, that final red flag. Like, I don't care if he loses his career. I don't care if he never flies again. Like, something has to happen now, you know. And I said to him, you know, if you're feeling so badly that you couldn't watch the Super Bowl, then you need to get help, you know. Don't, you know, I'll work. We'll figure this out. And I asked him directly, I said, are you feeling so badly that you're thinking about suicide? Have you been thinking about suicide? And he said, I could never do that to you and the boys. I would never do that to you and the boys.
That is exactly what my brother said.
I hear that from so many survivors that their loved one, they asked him directly and they said, I would never do that. And I believe that John meant that when he said that to me. But I think he sat there and thought about, and in a clouded state of mind, thinking that everybody would be better off without him, that the problem was him, and the way to solve the problem was to remove him, you know, because that's a typical military way of thinking, you know. And when you think about Joyner's theory, you know, John fit in that perfectly. He felt like his anxiety and his depression was now becoming a burden on everybody, his family, his friends, his peers, his Marines. He's losing that sense of belongingness to his unit because he was having trouble flying his own aircraft. And he had had, you know, really desensitized to physical and emotional pain throughout his life and throughout his career. So, you know, John promised me that he would go to mental health on that phone call. I asked him if I could call somebody to come pick him up, and he said, no, I don't want anybody to see me like this, you know. And he promised he would go, and he would call me when he got to the clinic. But, you know, all my sirens were going off in my head, and I actually drove right to the airport, got on the red eye to fly from Massachusetts to California to go with him, because even though my husband had a ticket to come home that Thursday, the Super Bowl was on a Sunday, he had a ticket to come home on Thursday because it was Joey's birthday. That was another like thing that went through my head when I was talking to him. Like, okay, he's making plans. He's bought a ticket to come home. That was also something else that decreased my anxiety about suicide. You know, but I knew that going to behavioral health was going to be the most difficult thing he did in his life. Harder than going to combat, harder than flying in night vision goggles, harder than, you know, anything he had ever done. And so my plan was to fly there and go with him to support him through this challenge. And when I landed in California that morning, you know, I started calling the different places because I had not heard from him. I called the clinic, I called the hospital, I called behavioral health, and I called his work, and nobody had seen him or heard from him. And in my heart, I just knew that I was too late. I rented a car and I drove to the hotel that he was staying in. And when I arrived there, there was Marine Corps cars kind of haphazardly parked in the parking lot. And I knew they were there for John. And I went into the, I didn't know where his room was. So I went into the office and I started yelling, you know, where's my husband? Can you tell me where my husband is? And this moment speaks in my head so clearly because it was the first real show of what my life was going to be like going forward, what it's like to lose a loved one to suicide, why postvention is so important, and why this journey is so difficult. Because the man behind the counter was on the phone, and he was frantically talking on the phone. He was saying, we've never had this happen, and what do we do? And I knew they were talking about John. And I said to him, it's my husband. Where is he? And the man looked at me, and he put the phone down slowly, and he backed up and went to a back room and closed the door slowly and locked it. So I think he just didn't know what to say to me. But it was like this huge realization for me that this was what it was going to be like. It was almost like the world had just completely shifted, and I just got a view of how very difficult this was going to be. And I walked out into the parking lot, and there was this awesome, like, Hispanic housekeeper who came over to me and hugged me and said, I'll take you to him. And she took me up the stairs. We went around the corner, and as we went around the corner, there was a Marine coming out of his room, and the Marine was crying. And he didn't have to say a word to me. He didn't have to say a word to me. I just fell to my knees, and he picked me up and carried me to another room. And I knew without anybody telling me that he had killed himself. And the detectives and the police said that he probably killed himself within a few hours of our phone call the night before. So this is where my whole journey began on postvention, because what happened at that scene really was all kinds of things that I knew could be better, that could be more helpful, that could have really shifted my journey. And I'll give you good examples of those, because these I look back now and I think about them as trainings for my mission, my new mission in life. So they took me into a room, and you know, suicides are a crime scene. So for survivors of suicide loss, there's these responders that are, you know, putting up questions, and there's this team that comes, including police, detectives, firemen. They sent what they call the trauma specialist, and they sent a Catholic priest, because my husband was identified as Catholic through the military. Even though we were off base, they sent local people. My big concern was what at that moment, you know, I was in shock, but I was thinking, what do I tell my children? How do I tell my children that their dad, who was their hero, their coach, had made it back from a combat zone where his life was on the line every day and then took his own life? Like, how do I explain that to the children? And I was in a real panic in trying to figure out how I tell them and what I tell them. And the information I got that day was horrible. The Catholic priest basically looked at me and said, well, you know what the Catholic Church thinks about suicide. And I said, actually, I don't. And he said, well, that's a sin. And I got so mad. I started saying to him, are you telling me that I'm supposed to tell my children that not only their dad is dead, but he's in hell? Is that what you're saying to me? And, you know, he just looked at me. I think he just didn't know what to say. I've since found out that the Catholic Church does not teach this or believe this, that this is old school thinking that actually developed as a prevention tool because they had so many people dying by suicide in several parishes, especially after World War II, and that they started talking about suicide as a sin in order to prevent suicide, so that it's not connected to biblical teachings or teachings within the Catholic Church. So
again, another connection is because Carson died when I was working at Regis University, which is a Jesuit Catholic school. And same thing, I learned through the Jesuits that the teaching had shifted, but they hadn't disseminated that information widely to the various priests and congregations because of the protective factor, perhaps, of the tenant. So that might be protective on the prevention side, but it's certainly complicating on the grief side.
The second person that gave me advice was the trauma specialist who told me that my children were too young to be told that it was suicide, that I should probably tell the children that it was an accident. And they were 8 and 10 and they were boys, right? And so the other piece that was really evident to me was, since I was a clinician and a social worker and a spouse, I felt at that time that I had lost my husband on my watch, that I was in some ways responsible for his death. I should have known. I should have saved him. So that made me not trust my instincts about anything.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I had been a good parent and trusted my parental instincts earlier, I now was in this position where I was looking for advice outside of me because I didn't trust my own instincts. So even though people were telling me things that didn't seem right, I didn't trust my gut to follow that instead of the advice I was given. So this is really important for people who are trying to help suicide loss survivors is make sure that they're connected with experts who really know the research behind what's best practice, how to help children, spiritual messages, because these survivors are in a very vulnerable state of trauma and shock, but also this difficulty in trusting their own instincts to follow their own skill sets or their own instincts around stuff. So that day, I had my children were with my sister, and I had my sister tell my children that my husband died from an accident. So I was starting my grief journey with many things amiss and all of my instincts saying, this is wrong, this feels wrong, this is not right, how are we gonna survive this? We had gone to Mass every Sunday, and I no longer felt comfortable in bringing the kids to the church for fear that they would be told that their dad was a sin or that it was suicide. I had started this grief journey on a lie. So I was afraid that people were going to say something to the children. I felt like I had to keep the children in the house and recluse myself to protect them. In my head, I was thinking, how am I going to help them with mental health and risk and talking about their dad when they don't even know that this is how he died? So everything was telling me it was wrong, but the information that I got was from supposed professionals. So it was a very confusing time. And I'll tell you, there was a second aha from, you know, the first aha was that this is what my journey is going to be like. The second one was 2 weeks after John's death, we were driving to Joey's 11th birthday party with my two boys in the car. And Joe said, Mom, I think I killed Dad. And, I looked in the rearview mirror and like, well, Joe, you know, what do you mean? And I pulled over on the side of the highway and, climbed in the back seat, and I said, what do you mean, honey? And he said, well, when Dad was home at Christmas, we were having nachos, and I asked Dad if we could salt the nachos, and he said no, because, too much salt is not good for your heart. And when he wasn't looking, I salted the nachos. So Dad must have had some kind of an accident with his heart. And so this, it was like a huge lightning bolt hitting me that this journey was going to be up to me, that I had to trust my instincts, and that we had to start over, and that all we really had in starting over was trust and love and honesty. And that I had to start over with those three things, and I had to start right there in that car. And so I did. I told the kids about their dad's struggles with mental health, with depression. I told them that he took his own life, and that we were going to start over as a family. And from then forward, I was going to tell them the truth as best I could, and that I was going to be honest with them, and that together we were going to rebuild our family, and that we were going to be okay. And so that was the beginning, really, of me rebuilding the family, I would say, at least 2 weeks after his death. Mm.
Wow. I've heard your story before, and I get teared up every time. The image of you, I know, walking into that scene with the clerk behind the desk and the Hispanic housekeeper and the Marine crying. I mean, that is the tragedy scene that has played out in so many families, and you just never forget that. Both the compassion piece as well as the people who turned their backs on you. So thank you so much for sharing that incredible, poignant, and powerful story of reclaiming your family and moving forward. Let's shift now for the last part here about kind of the science that informs your work with the military today, your work in postvention and in grief support, and some takeaways for our listeners who may or may not be military connected on how they can help families and communities.
Okay, great. So we know that families who are exposed to suicide are at more risk for suicide themselves. There's all kinds of studies, like Berman in 2011 said that there was 4.5 to 7.5 immediate family members and up to 15 to 20 extended family members who are intimately and directly affected to suicide. So we've kind of changed those numbers since Snyderman days of 6 lost survivors per suicide loss. That it's now increased, I think. And so like you say, there's a ripple effect from suicide loss, beginning with the most intimately affected, all the way out to their peers in the military, to their work mates, to their neighborhood and others. And with children, children of those who lose a parent to suicide are also significantly increased risk for suicide loss themselves. So for me, there's the suicide loss survivors, there's risk assessment mixed with healing and mixed with the grief. And so we've kind of set up programs to kind of look at it in 3 different sections. Suicide loss survivors often need stabilization. That because they're at risk, there needs to be a risk assessment to figure out, are they at more risk? There needs to be an assessment of all these things that I just talked about, these spiritual questions. What are the messages they've been told? What are some of the, things that they've been told by their spiritual community or by their growing up? And we find that many, in our group, about 60% of our survivors leave their organized religion and identify themselves as something else after a death by suicide. So that's an important fact for people who are in the faith communities and trying to care for suicide loss survivors, that messaging sometimes around suicide loss really has survivors reclusing themselves instead of moving closer to their religious organizations. And so for suicide loss survivors, it's really important that their religious organizations are able to discuss openly what the Bible says about suicide, to decrease anxiety about the afterlife for suicide loss survivors, and this concept of sin. We also find in suicide loss survivors that there's this not only risk of suicide in the survivors, but there's also potential for growth. There's been a lot of studies by Moore and Sorrell and Jobes around this, that there's kind of this complex mix of psychological injury mixed with psychological and spiritual growth. What we term as post-traumatic growth is something that we see in survivors all the time. And I think it's because many of us, and you're a good example of this, and I think I'm a good example of this, and there's so many others in the field, like Iris Bolton and Kevin Tynes and Loretta Archibald and others who have tremendous growth following a death by suicide in their family. We see this in our suicide loss survivors. And I think it's because most of us are trying to find some kind of meaning that's connected to this death. This death seems like it's such a loss that could have been prevented, that was something that is maybe confusing and also a useless death. So survivors of suicide are very often looking to find meaning in that death and find new purpose in their life because of that death. So,
yep.
You know, we found that many of them actually, once they get through that grief journey and that initial stabilization, looking for ways to find growth in their life. And, you know, there's Calhoun and Tedeschi in 2006 and 2008 termed post-traumatic growth, and we see it a lot in suicide loss survivors. I have a really good personal story about this where I started to see growth not only in myself but in my boys. We bought a little, and John's squadron gave us a little bit of money after his death, and they said, you know, buy something for the boys to remind them of John. And we bought this little fishing boat, and we named it the Johnny Rock, which was his nickname. And so that little fishing boat kind of became this metaphor for our grief journey. The first day that we put it in the water, we pushed off from the dock, and Joey and I were in that boat. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, go ahead, drive it, Mom." And I looked at him and I said, "I thought you knew how to drive it." Neither one of us knew how to drive the darn boat. And we were floating up the river, and, you know, we had to flag someone down to come over and tell us, you know, how to get the boat. They looked at us like we were crazy, but they actually got in the boat, showed us how to start it, to steer it and everything. And so Joe, who was about 12 years old then, started steering this boat up the river, and I was sitting there in front of him. And as we went up the river, there was all this beauty. There was swans, and there was turtles, and there was an egret, and there was seagulls there, and the sounds of the water was really beautiful. And I turned around to look at my son, who was a 12-year-old boy driving this boat, and there was tears running down his face. And I immediately thought, oh, he's missing his dad. He's sad, you know, and so I'm like, "Are you okay, Joe? What's the matter? Is it dad?" And he said, "No, Mom, it's just so beautiful." And I thought,
you made me cry
again.
story.
You know, a 12-year-old boy is seeing the world differently because of his loss, right? Because he had had this intense loss, he now felt things in a different way, saw life in a different way, appreciated little things in life in a different way. And I've seen that in my own family, but also in many, many suicide loss survivors. So I would encourage people, when you are working with suicide loss survivors, to remember that there's both sides of this journey for them, that there's this tremendous pain and tremendous emotions that are complicated, but there's also an opportunity for enormous growth and for them to, you know, see the world and participate in the world in a healthier, more joyful way.
Wow, that is such an incredible story. And like learning to you know, operate this boat and going upstream. I mean, the whole metaphor is such an incredible thing. Have you published anything about that particular part of your story?
No, I haven't actually. No, but I thought about it.
You must.
You know,
you must.
Yeah.
That is just a gorgeous story. Great. So let me wrap up here. I'll ask you for some final thoughts in just a second so you can kind of think about what you want to say in closing.
Yeah.
But just to recap, we've talked about so much in the last hour. We talked about, you know, the paradox of this kind of traumatic grieving and some of those tensions and postvention that are really hard to navigate. We heard this incredibly poignant story of you and your husband and your family, and woven within that the complications of the messages that we receive, not only from the military, but, you know, particularly in the military, around don't tell, tough it out. Don't be weak. And in the military or first responder communities in particular, you know, that risk of losing clearance, losing your career, losing your identity, especially when so much of your identity is in that basket of being that person, and you don't want to risk it. And then also from the family perspective, really becoming what you call cheerleaders, and I would also say co-conspirators around, mm-hmm. you know, we've got to keep this silent, we've got to keep this quiet, and just kind of push through. So that was a really big part of the story that I wanted to call out. Piece that you made very clear was this unresolved history of trauma, and that when mm-hmm. we don't face that, when we don't work through that, it doesn't go away. It's like it's a bucket that gets filled up, and when the additional traumas happen in later in life, all of that comes back and the bucket spills over. And so I think there's been a real movement in our field, not just to ask what's wrong with you, but to start to ask what happened to you and to go back mm-hmm. to those earlier traumas, really understand how they're all linked together. You made a very brief mention about his military service and how that was connected perhaps to some moral injury pieces. We didn't have a chance mm-hmm. to kind of totally flesh that out, but I'll throw some things in the show notes about that because that's also been a pretty hot topic right now in trying to understand mm-hmm. Some of the very difficult decisions that our warriors make and how that affects their psyche. You talked a lot about the outward-facing signs. When somebody's not disclosing fully the level of their despair. And so I want to highlight that, too, for our listeners who are feeling in their gut that something's wrong, but they're really not getting the full story verbally. The agitation, the decrease in patience, the losing weight, and that numbness. You know, they might not disclose they're thinking about suicide, but they might talk about, I can't feel anything anymore. And I know when I went through my own depression, that was the part that was most jarring for me because I'm such a kind of sensory-oriented person in my, you know, joy and everything. And I was totally numb, and it was very disconcerting. You painted such a picture of the death scene response and how much we can learn from that. I mean, again, the metaphor of people locking themselves away, the messages from faith communities about a sin and how that really complicates everything. And your boldness of kind of reclaiming your instincts on how to talk to your children. There's some really good resources I'll also throw in the show notes there, Dougie Center and Judy's House. And because I know this is such a difficult thing that families experience, and your son's internalizing it is often the consequence when the kids aren't able to give, you know, able to have a story that makes sense. When they have a story that has gaps in it or it doesn't make sense to them, they will fill in the gaps with their own reasoning. And it often is, yes. because of their level of development, it's often centered on their responsibility. So I killed dad is a narrative that often gets generated when the kids don't have the full story. So super mm-hmm. important, again, to surround yourself with people who understand this, because you're not going to be able to do it well, you know, just on instinct. You did talk quite a bit about suicide, clinician survivor piece, and so I will add some of those in the show notes too. And the part about someone died on my watch and I can't trust my own instincts is so prevalent, and really pulls a number of us out of the field. I stopped doing clinical work after Carson died because I just felt like I couldn't be held responsible for making good decisions around it. The domino effect of loss also came up for you, as it does for many families, about kind of the loss of faith, the loss of faith community, the networks changing and all of that. And so I'm so happy to hear that you've also been working in that space to help our faith communities do a better job of surrounding us. I felt very fortunate. My faith community did absolutely all the right things. I don't know how they figured it out, but, you know, and I know it's possible to have that kind of support. And then the last thing I want to share is that post-traumatic growth piece. And again, I'll throw in some resources there, that meaning making, that purpose finding. And I'm going to really follow up with you on writing up your fishing boat metaphor, because that is such an incredible piece. So what a rich, rich content that you have brought to us. So many resources, so many great things. What are some of your closing thoughts as we come to the end of our hour?
Well, thank you. That's amazing to hear it back. So mm-hmm. one thing that I think is really important to say is that the military has changed a lot since the 10 years ago when my husband first had his depression. When he first had his suicide and when he had his depression, it's changed a lot. And so there is an ability to get help and maintain your career now. It really does happen, and it happens all the time.
So important to know.
And so, you know, I would encourage spouses out there and service members who are struggling to seek help, but seek help for whenever things start to be problems, little things. Anxiety and sleeplessness and agitation and communication problems between, you know, partners, that you know, there's lots of resources now. And you can get help and get better and maintain your career, but the sooner you go and get help, the better. And I've seen lots of people get help, and really all the way up to generals who've gotten better and been promoted to general. So please do that. And there's lots of
resources. Do you have
any resources
that you can you highlight just a couple of resources that people can go to learn more about CAPS, to learn more about how to get mental health stuff?
If you're active duty in the military, there is always behavioral health that you can walk into and talk to. But you can also go to the chaplain, which is private, and they cannot tell anybody that you're coming and talking to them. That's a good starting place for resources. If you're uncomfortable with going on base, you can call Given Hour. Given Hour is free, unlimited counseling for service members and their families and veterans. It's a Given Hour. You can look it up online, and they're in communities all across. There's also vet centers for veterans who have had combat experience that's separate from the VA and confidential. There's also a peer support line that is through the Department of Defense now. If you go to DSPO.mil, they have a peer line that you can call in and talk about all kinds of issues and get more resources. There's also Vets for Warriors, that is for all active duty. That's a great line that I highly recommend. They have all different kinds of services branches represented there with lots of information. There's, of course, the National Veterans Crisis Line, that if you are in crisis, you can call there and you can get information for your loved one if they're in crisis, or you can call yourself if you're in crisis and find resources. There's Military OneSource that has counseling and referrals for military. I mean, we could go on and on. And then for CAPS, CAPS provides comprehensive peer-based support, resources, and referrals for anyone who is grieving a death of a military loved one who served, whether it's a veteran or active duty. We have it for all types of deaths, everything killed in action, accidental, unknown deaths. Illnesses is one of our biggest growing populations, or cancer deaths exposed to burn pits. And we especially have comprehensive care for suicide loss.
And what's the TAPS website?
Yep. So TAPS, just go to TAPS.org. And you can also, we have a 24/7 call line. It's 1-800-959-8277. And it's answered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Fabulous. Well, we'll drop all of these resources in the show notes. And if you have a ready-to-go list, I can just cut and paste. That would save me a ton of time, because you just rattled off like 20.
Yep.
Thank you so much. So this has been such a incredible experience. My heart has swelled. I have teared up several times. So I know it's going to be very impactful for our listeners. So thank you so much for all of it.
Thank you so much.
You're absolutely welcome. So for more episodes of the podcast, just go to my website, SallySpencerThomas.com. I'm doing as we're launching here, a little contest. So if you subscribe to my newsletter, subscribe to the podcast, and leave a rating and review, you'll be in the drawing for a $100 Amazon gift card. So please do that and spread the word. Sign up for the newsletter. We'll be announcing future podcasts and Twitter chats and all kinds of stuff. So let's learn together. So closing, let's open our hearts. Let's challenge our thinking of take action and save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Thank you so much.
Sally?
Once upon a time, there was a new crossover that refused to play by the rules. It flipped the script and made all the others look like fools. Featuring styling that's sexier by far and handles like a rock star. Introducing the first ever Toyota CHR.
Enjoy agile handling in the body of a seductive crossover that comes with standard 18-inch alloy wheels. The first ever Toyota CHR. The perfect ride to spin your own tale. Toyota. Let's go places.